following program is recommended for mature individuals and may contain material unsuitable for morons, cretins, and dishwipes. If you are a moron or a member of the PTL Club, please turn off your radio, because we don't need any more stupid, narrow-minded, pencil-neck geeks who wouldn't know the First Amendment if it came up and bit them on the butt. Thank you.
Alrighty, it is time for episode 8 of Chat with a Cat. I am recording this on Monday, February 23rd, or February 24th. This is prior to Sim 4 of the 1981 Season 2 of the NPBSL. So hopefully that gives everybody a little bit of bearing as to what is going on in this podcast. It's still early in the season, and that leads me to the thing that has kind of been, sticking in my craw for the last few days. I've been trying to figure out how to approach it, and finally I decided, you know what, I'm just going to approach it. One of the things that I thought was interesting was the Town Hall number 2 questions for season 81. The questions were, what do you think of the results after one sim? What's real? What's an aberration? And who did you not expect to have the start they did? And I think the question and answer, quite frankly, that stuck out to me was the, you know, what's real question. And I'm going to apologize in advance for picking on the Lakers. But the Lakers said the +5 point differential is real after one sim. We're now 3 sims in, and their point differential is down to 1.5. So it's going in the wrong direction. And so it made me think, how do you know what's real? How, you know, when you're trying to evaluate what's going on in a league, how do you know what you're doing? How do you judge whether or not you're on the right path? Whether or not you have something that is sustainable, whether something can be explained by the law of small numbers. And I thought it's time to, in very general terms, talk about the way that I look at Sim League. And I think I look at it in a way that maybe is a little bit different than other folks. Maybe it's because I've tried to code my own versions of basketball games in the past, and so I've had to think about how things have to work under the hood. But I think the best way to describe it is this way, and it is to imagine that you are matched up with someone, and you're playing a game where the name of the game is each of you gets to roll 50 dice, and whoever comes up with the highest total is the winner. Now, in a totally fair game where everybody gets exactly 50 rolls and the dice are all fair, every die, assuming you're using a 6-sided die, you're not using the funky Dungeons & Dragons dice, is going to have an average value of 3.5, because at most you can get a 6, at least you can get a 1. If all the sides are equally likely, then on average you roll 3.5, you know, some 1s, some 6s. And so for 50 rolls, your average roll is going to be 75. And you're going to have a bell curve distribution where most of the stuff hovers around 75. And so let's back up for a minute and put that in basketball terms, or in Sim League terms. Every possession in basketball, if you will, is a throw of the dice. And possessions can end in only a few discrete ways. They can end in a made three-pointer. They can end in a made two-pointer. They can end in a made free throw. They can end in a dead ball turnover, which would be throwing the ball out of bounds, traveling, something where you get to get back and get your defense set. They can end in a live ball turnover, also known as a steal by the opposition. Or they can end in what I would call a neutral state, whereby you have a missed shot. That could be the missed final free throw. It could be a missed field goal. And then there's kind of a secondary split there where it can either end in the ball going out of bounds, in which case it winds up being essentially the same as either an unforced turnover if it was off of you, where it's out of bounds, the other team gets possession. It could be out of bounds to you, so it's like an offensive rebound, basically, or it can be a rebound, offensive or defensive. But the point is, essentially, you start another possession, and either your team has possession of the ball and the other team has possession of the ball. So when you think of it that way, where a basketball game is simply a series of possessions, you realize that after every made shot that ends a possession, your opponent is going to have possession of the basketball. And so for made shots, there's always going to be the same number of possessions. If each team shot 100%, oh, there is one more now that I think about it. There is one more potential ending to a possession, and that could be described as time expiring. And you could say that's, you know, for a shot clock violation, that's a dead ball turnover. But it could be end of game. You could say end of quarter or end of half, but you can simplify end of quarter or end of half to basically a missed shot with a rebound that goes to the team that has possession to start the next quarter. So there's really only one time when the timeout thing happens. And if it happens when the score is tied, it's again like a rebound. Somebody's going to get possession of the ball. If it happens when the score is not tied, then the game is over. So I don't really include that as one of the possible outcomes of a possession. So the next thing to ask yourself is, okay, so I'm in a game where anytime I make a field goal, the other team gets the ball, and they're going to have the chance to make a field goal. So assume everybody shoots 100%, you're going to go back and forth forever, assuming, again, everybody's scoring the same number of points. So now, once you have that in your mind, that this is a game of possessions and points per possession, then you can drill in and you can start asking yourself, how can I affect the game and try to weight it so that it turns in my favor? So pace is not a consideration here normally. In real basketball, pace can be a consideration. One of the best examples is traditionally the Denver Nuggets in the 80s were a run and gun team because they played at altitude, and most other teams weren't used to the altitude, and so they would fatigue and become less efficient as the game wore on. I don't know that I've really seen that in the Sim League, because the Sim League doesn't know exactly, you know, how high each of the stadiums is located relative to each other. So let's back it up for a minute. So I can either improve my average points per possession. One way to do that would be by launching more three-pointers, and while keeping my field goal percentage up. You know, the classic caveat applies here. 33% on threes is the same as 50% on twos. You wind up with 1 point per shot attempt. And so if you can get your points per shot attempt up, that is either by improving your shooting percentage or shooting more three-pointers or by drawing fouls and getting more and ones, then you can improve your chances to win. You can also, you improve your field goal percentage. You know, if you're shooting 55%, your opponent's shooting 50%, you're making more points on average than he is. The next way to affect this is to bring your opponent's field goal percentage down. This is done by defense and lowering their ability to make baskets. The other way you can affect the outcome in your favor is to have more possessions than your opponent. Statistically, and this matches what we see in the NBA, but if you look at the team leaders on rebounding percentage, the rebounding percentage in the league right now, the Bullets are number one at 53.8, the Spurs are 43.2. So on average, the Bullets are getting more possessions than other teams are. The Spurs are getting fewer possessions than other teams are by virtue of getting fewer rebounds. Now, that's also offset somewhat by field goal percentage. If you are shooting a higher field goal percentage, there are fewer of your own offensive rebounds available for you to grab. So it's also worth looking at rebound percentage in terms of offensive and defensive rebounding. The high on defensive rebounding right now is 75%. The low is 62%. By contrast, the offensive rebound percentage, the high is 35%, the low is 23%. So if you look on average, that's about a 70-30 rate where on a missed shot, 70% of the time, give or take, the defense gets the rebound. 30% of the time, the offense gets the rebound. So if you massively improve your defensive rebounding, you are taking away some of the possessions your opponents would otherwise have by offensive rebounds. Similarly, if you improve your offensive rebounding, you are adding to your own possessions by virtue of getting rebounds that would otherwise have gone to the defense. Steals and turnovers work the same way. The more often you get steals, the more frequently you will have a bonus possession where anytime a possession ends in a turnover, it ends in 0 points. So it's an inefficient possession. So you want to avoid turnovers for yourself as much as possible, and you want to maximize turnovers on the other team, which is normally done by way of steals. Unforced turnovers are a lot harder to come by. Blocks, I think, are a secondary stat because they don't directly stop scoring. They tend to push it down, but not every shot that is blocked is going to go in. So I think a steal is a more valuable commodity than a block, because a steal definitely gives you possession of the ball. A block turns into a rebound. 70% of the time it's going to your opposition, and there's no guarantee the shot was going to go in anyway. And so one of the things that you could look at in the team leaders page is you can look at offensive and defensive efficiency. And offensive efficiency basically tells you how many points do you score on average per 100 possessions. The better you are on that, the more you have put the odds in your favor. Similarly, defensive efficiency is how many points do you give up. And again, the better your odds, or the better you do there, the better the odds are in your favor. But the real key is the differential between those two. And that is what really helps make the odds for efficiency in your favor. If you have a low offensive efficiency, but you have an even better defensive efficiency, it doesn't matter that your offense sucks. Your defense outweighs it. Similarly, if you have an amazing offense and you have an absolutely awful defense, it doesn't matter how much you're scoring. The other team is doing the same thing. And I'm going to take the Mavericks as an example. The Mavericks are currently number 5 in the league in offensive efficiency. They're averaging 108.9 points per 100 possessions, which is 5th in the league. It's really, really good. But their defensive efficiency is 108.6. So even though they are above average offensively, they're below average defensively, and it winds up being basically even. So in efficiency, they're not gaining any advantage. And so then you have to ask yourself, okay, if you look at possessions, where do they rank? And if you look at their rebound percentage, they're 10th in the league, so almost in the middle at 51.8%. And if you search for their turnover margin, and again, I'm going to focus on margin, the Mavericks are actually last in the league right now in turnovers, but they have a high pace. But they're also one of the last enforcing opponents' turnovers. And so you would expect that since the Mavericks are a little better than average in terms of efficiency, and quite a bit worse than average in terms of possessions, they're going to be under 500, because being average in one area and below average the other means you're going to have a hard time winning. And that is borne out by their 10-11 record. They're just slightly under 50%. So to go back to the Lakers, and unfortunately I can't go back and pull up the stats page as it sat after the first game. But I'm going to talk for a minute about why I looked at the Lakers saying their plus 5 point differential was real and just shook my head. is if I take a look at the Lakers' rebound percentage, let's say, because that's a pretty good proxy for how many more possessions you're getting, because there are many, many more rebounds in a game than there are steals and turnovers. The Lakers right now are at 52.4% in rebounding percentage. So they're a little above average, but they're not ridiculously above average. And then if I look at their turnover percentage, they're 15.9%. The middle of the league is 15.9%, so they're right average there. So they're not running away with a differential in possessions. And then if I look at their efficiency, they're 14th, right in the middle of offensive efficiency. If I look at their defensive efficiency, they're 11th, right in the middle. The difference between the two is about 1.2 points. So they're not getting extra possessions. They're not being more efficient with their possessions. And so to me, that says you're not going to be able to maintain a plus 5 point differential. You're mediocre. Your plus five early is going to regress to the mean. And that, lo and behold, is exactly what happened. And then to further go into that, when I look at the Lakers, you know, in terms of how do I see their team constructed? And now I'm just going to look at their ratings. I'm not going to look at their statistical numbers. They have one exceptional rebounder in James Donaldson, but he's not going to be able to do it himself. And then if you look at the rest of his starters, Jamal Wilkes has a 35 in defensive rebounding, Trapuka 16, World Be Free 18, Brad Davis 17. So you have one amazing rebounder with 100 defensive rebounding in James Donaldson, and then everybody else is absolutely awful. Now he's getting around that by not starting all four of those players, although they're playing the most minutes. He has started Jim Brewer and Larry Keenan in various stretches. Brewer has a 63 defensive rebounding rating. Keenan has a 37, so Keenan probably isn't helping him much at all. But you know, you can see there they're not going to out-rebound teams. James Donaldson may have a lot of rebounds, but because the rest of the team is awful, teams are going to be able to at least match and sometimes exceed the Lakers on the boards. If you look at their defensive ratings, Donaldson has a 79 in post defense. Wilkes has a 62 in perimeter defense. World Be Free has a 57. Brad Davis has a 63 in perimeter defense. So they're okay. They're not great. So are they going to hold their opponents down? No. Do they have anybody who's amazing in steals? No. So the question I would ask to the Lakers, when you saw that first sim and you saw that that plus five differential and you thought, oh, this is real, what basis did you have other than hope to say this is real? The ratings of your players didn't support it, and we're seeing the results of that. I'm not saying your team is bad. What I am saying is that the ratings of your players don't support a differential. And it takes some time to understand which ratings are important and which ratings affect various things. One of the ratings I don't want to say it's overrated, because it's the difference between getting a shot off and having a turnover, is the inside rating. We see high inside ratings and we think, oh, these players are going to be exceptional scorers. But there's an old phrase in basketball, there's only one ball. You can't put five 30-point scorers together on a team and expect them all to score 30 points. Usually there's a pecking order and there's only room for one 30-point scorer on a team. Maybe there's two if everybody else is scoring in single digits. And so you do need one or two very good, high-rated inside scoring players to make sure you can generate offense. But if you have a team that is full of great inside scorers, they're all going to cancel each other out. You know, somebody, you don't get more shots by having a high inside rating. Because you have to have a possession for that. You get more shots by rebounding. You get more shots by steals. You get more shots by having a high handling rating so that you avoid turnovers yourself. All of the ratings, and this is one of the things I think makes basketball in general and simulated basketball in particular fun, is there's no one rating that makes you invincible if you max it out. And so because of that, I could ask myself, what other teams do I look at? And I think they're doing well now, but do I think this is an illusion? And I will say, if I'm looking at teams that I think are their current starts are more illusion than not. Just looking at the top of the Midwest, I don't think the Kings, who are currently sitting at 60-6, are going to win 75% of their games all season. I'm sorry, Darth, I don't. They weren't that great last season. Yes, Gminski made a jump, but, again, where is the overwhelming advantage in efficiency? And the answer right now is it's been in their defense. They're currently third in the league in opponents' field goal percentage. They're right in the middle of the pack in their own field goal percentage. But if I take a look at their defensive skills, Gminski and Sikma's post-defense is 73-65. That's not a great defender. Those are decent to good defenders, but I would hope, my big men are going to have better than average post-defenses. And then if I look at their perimeter guys, again, 62, 64, 64. Alan Lavelle has a 74, so he's a little better than average, but they don't have any lockdown defenders. So I think some of what you're seeing is the law of small numbers, and I think the Kings are going to regress to the mean. I don't want to pick on them unduly. And it's the same thing with the Knicks. We all know the Knicks started off, the first two Sims were undefeated. Now, I do think the Knicks have the players with the ratings to keep that up. They have several exceptional defenders. Buck Williams has a 91 defensive rebounding and 82 post-defense. Dave Corzine, 72 post-defense, 78 defensive rebounding. So 72 isn't great, but it's good. If you look at their perimeter players, most of them are in the 60s, but they all have 85, 84, 88, 73, 100 steals. So they have the ability to turn the ball over. So they're going to have additional turnovers. They don't have a weakness necessarily on rebounding. Not all of their players are great, but none of them for their position are bad. So again, here, I think the Knicks have the ability to sustain. They're not going to go undefeated the entire season. Nobody is. But I think they have the ability to sustain the lead in their division in the way that the Kings do not. And again, this is just reading into ratings and how does that affect your efficiency, your opponent's efficiency, and turnovers. I apologize for harping on that. And, again, I'm sorry to the Lakers for kind of jumping on them in particular. But, like I said, what basis do you have to believe your performance is real? And I could even turn it around on myself. The Trailblazers had a slow start last season. They had a slow start this season. What basis did I have last season I did not believe they could go as far in the playoffs as they did, but I did think that they could make the playoffs even when they were, several games under 500 early in the season and performing poorly in many categories. And the reason I felt that way is the ratings relative to the stats in those categories did not match early. And that tells me that variance is due to the randomness. It's due to the die rolls. Over the course of an 82-game season, those things tend to even out. And so it's one of the things that I've tried very hard not to do this season is not overreact. Believe me, it's been tempting. So that's something that I think is interesting. We're going to take a quick break here because what I'd like to do when I come back is now that we passed the December 15th deadline for moving players that were traded in the offseason a second time. I want to see who do I think is looking for trades. We already saw one go off earlier today between the Bullets and the Sonics. And maybe we'll get some ideas of who's doing what going forward. So we'll be back shortly.
It's time for your daily meditation with your host, Tim.
Hi. Today, let's imagine a warm, moist, tropical rainforest during a gentle rain. Let's relax and enjoy the sounds of the rainforest. Oh, look, there's a cute little monkey. Hi, monkey. And a trombone. Let's imagine we're walking along a winding path through the dense foliage. We're not in a hurry. We're just enjoying the sights, the sounds, the smells. Excuse me. We're just walking along without a care in the world, not concerned at all with the slippery mud underfoot.
Whoa!
Or the anvil overhead. Oh dear, looks like you need an ambulance. Hope it doesn't lose traction in the soft, brown mud. The accident seems to have frightened the monkey. And the trombone. And the drill press. And the flock of geese. And the class of second graders. And the monster truck.
Join us tomorrow for another daily meditation.
How often do you think about the air you breathe? Oxygen, gas of life, or secret military death vapor? Tonight.
All right, we are back, and as promised, I wanted to talk a little bit about trades. Now that everybody who was traded in the offseason is eligible to be traded again, entire rosters are available. There's not restrictions on, oh, I can't move this guy, I guess with the exception of the just-completed Bullets Sonics trade. But I'd rather look at what teams may be thinking of doing rather than at specific players. And so I want to start with the Atlantic Division. The Knicks, I think, are in a position at 17-4 where they probably don't want to mess with a lot. They're doing very, very well. If they can find a trade that helps them on the margins, fine. But when you've run out to this kind of a start in your division, I don't think there's any pressure on them to make a trade. I don't see any teams that are particularly awful matchups for them. I think they have the roster to, obviously there can always be a bad matchup in the playoffs. I mentioned before last season when the Blazers matched up with the Nets, I thought it was a particularly bad matchup based on the way that Daryl Dawkins was playing. So the Knicks could get had by a bad matchup, but you know, the good news for them is they have Buck Williams that they could switch on a high value post player. I'm not sure if they go up against somebody who's torching them on the outside exactly what they do there. They don't have a great lockdown perimeter defender, so that could be the Knicks' Achilles heel, but there aren't very many of those to be had in the league. And so, again, I don't think the Knicks are looking for much. The Bullets obviously have already made a trade. The Bullets are a team that I think is trying to retool themselves. I mentioned at the beginning of the season they're a little bit thin up front. I still think after the David Greenwood pickup, they're still a little bit thin, especially with all of the great power forwards and the two towers lineups. I like Calvin Natt as an undersized three. I don't like him as a four trying to go up against some of the bigger guys. So I think the Greenwood trade could be the first step. I do think the Bullets could be looking to add one more big piece, and they have several draft picks that they could use for it. They have the Jazz pick, they have the Lakers pick, and if they find somebody who's willing to give them a big man for one or both of those picks, I think the Bullets could make a move. The Celtics, their big move in the offseason was moving off of Kareem and getting Bernard King. And I'll be honest, I did not see Bernard King making the leap that he's made this year. Maybe I wouldn't have traded him. He's shooting 59% from the field, averaging 36 points a game. The Celtics backcourt is absolutely terrifying. The Celtics are probably also looking for a bit of supplement to their big men. I don't think they can make it through the gauntlet of the Eastern playoffs unless they have a good big man to either offset or shut down the Twin Tower lineups, especially out of Milwaukee. You know, we saw the Pacers did well last season. This year, I think now that Milwaukee is healthy, they're kind of the class of the East. But, you know, both years the class of the East have been dominant big men. So that's something you have to worry about. The Nets kind of surprised me. The defending champs are only 9-12. They've gotten off to a slow start, and it probably hasn't helped that Cliff Robinson has been injured. So, you know, Daryl Dawkins is still doing his thing, but T.R. Dunn has really fallen off a cliff production-wise this year. Dunn and Drew are shooting 45 and 43%. That's just not good enough. So I can see New Jersey trying to bring in some backcourt help, because I think, you know, Herb Williams and Daryl Dawkins have the front court taken care of, but they're not efficient enough from their guards. And so I can see New Jersey wanting to pull the trigger there. They're still within shouting distance. The 76ers are 6-14, but their point differential is a negative 7.8. That tells me they should be even worse than they are. I think if I was the 76ers, I would not be really worried about competing this season. And quite frankly, most of their good players are relatively young. They could start shopping Michael Thompson. I think at 26, they probably could get something back for him, especially from those teams that are looking for one more big. But I wouldn't expect a lot of moves from the 76ers unless they get some sort of prospects offer they can't refuse. The Bucks are 15-4. This is the version of the Bucks I think everybody was scared that they were going to see last season. They have five players averaging double digits. They're running roughshod over the league. Their point differential is 11.5. I don't think, because we're still too close to the creation draft when talent was still relatively evenly spread, I don't think they'll finish the season at 11.5, but they could be in the high nines. You know, it's a team that I think ran into a bad matchup last season. Lambeer wasn't quite ready, but this season it's going to take a lot to knock them out. I think they're definitely the favorites, and I wouldn't expect them to make any moves unless something falls into their lap. Maybe they could make a move on the edges for like an eighth man of the rotation, but they're not going to make anything serious. The Bulls have surprised me a little bit this season. I didn't think, especially after Steve Johnson took a step back in training camp, that they would be able to play at the level they have. Michael Cooper continues to be a bit of a disappointment offensively. He's only averaging 11 points, but he's an amazing defender, and he's only 25. If I were in Logan's shoes, what would I do? Would I try to make a move to vault myself into contention, or would I try to sell off? I think the answer is I would probably be looking to move either Marvin Webster or Sven Nader to one of those teams that is starved for big man help, and try to get a little bit younger. And maybe Nader is the one that they can move, since he's currently their backup. He's only averaging 8 points in 17 minutes. I'm not going to say if you double his minutes, you double his points, but he certainly is probably capable of putting up 14 to 15 points and maybe 10 rebounds on a team that starts him. So I think Sven Nader is definitely probably the Bulls' best trading piece. The Pacers, after running over the league last year, have dropped back to 500. And I think that's a function of they just don't have a lot of depth behind Dantley and Joe Barry Carroll. Wes Unseld at 35 has regressed significantly this year, and Al Wood at 23 isn't ready. What do they need? They probably need a point guard to get the ball to JBC and to Adrian. Do they have the assets to pull it off that they're willing to part with is the question. I don't know that they do. It's one of the downsides to being one of the top teams in the league is you don't get the best draft picks. They don't have a lot of young talent that isn't integral to their success. So I think the Pacers would like to make a move. I just don't think they're going to be able to find someone who's willing to pull the trigger. The Cavaliers are another team that is currently on the outside of the playoffs looking in, but maybe could make a run at it. They have an amazing backcourt. What they have not been able to find is enough front court help. And I don't know that that's going to be forthcoming in the draft. They're kind of in limbo where you're not bad enough to get a high lottery pick, but you're not good enough to threaten in the playoffs. So I can see the Cavaliers trying to either jettison some future assets to load up on talent now, or I could see them trying to make a trade where they trade away one of their pieces, maybe Kenny Carr, to try to get younger and maybe get another draft pick or two so they can add something on the offensive end at one of the forward spots. Because right now they don't have it. And I don't see them being huge movers in the trade market just because I don't think they have a lot of assets they want to get rid of. But I can also see if something presents itself, they would jump on it. The Hawks are 6-15. This is a team that probably needs to be in sell mode. Dennis Johnson is 27, so he's in his athletic prime. I think this is the point where you start trying to build around Jeff Rulon, Kurt Nymphius. They're 23. DJ can probably get you a pretty good return. They're going nowhere with him now, and by the time they're ready to go somewhere with him, he's not going to be there. So I think they should be looking to move Johnson for what they can get for him. Next up is the Pistons. They have had a miserable season, which we kind of expected because they sent out most of their players to stock up on draft picks. They've got 7 first round picks and 6 second round picks. Over the next 3 seasons, all of their quality talent is 25 and under. So I don't see the Pistons doing a lot to make moves just because I think the talent that they have is going to be too expensive to try to come get. And they're not going to be looking to add talent because they're looking at picking another high draft pick. The Kings, I talked a little bit about earlier. They're currently sitting on top of the Midwest. I think that's a little bit of a mirage. I do think Jay Vincent has been a surprise for them, but I just don't quite trust the defense of this team to hold up. I also know that Darth is a little bit impatient, and so if we see some slippage, I could see him making a move to try to stabilize his hold on the Midwest. The Nuggets are right on their heels. They made their big swing in the offseason for Dan Roundfield. I really like that combination of Roundfield, English, Lucas. Again, this is a team that I think could do some tinkering on the margins, but I don't think, I like their core. I think it's solid. I don't think they have the assets that they need to make a big splash, so I think they just stay the course. The Jazz, this is an interesting one. They started hot. They've kind of cooled off. Vandeweghe is still amazing. Tom Chambers looks like a good running mate, but what they lack are young pieces around them. They have a lot of guys that are in their late 20s, early 30s, and if I were the Jazz, you kind of risk being in that area. This is a playoff team, but it's a low-end playoff team, and they're not going to get a lot of help through the draft. So I think the Jazz could be a team that you see trying to jettison some future aspects for help now, or a team that decides we're going to jettison some help now stuff for future talent to build around English and Chambers. They could go either way. And so which way should they go? It really depends on what the trade market looks like. What I don't think we have a ton of win now pieces out there. So I kind of think they would be more inclined to trade one of their low-grade starters for future assets, but yeah, you never know. The Mavericks are 10-11. It's a team that, you know, they've got George Gervin, but he's 29. Truck Robinson is 30. Dan Issel's 33. Caldwell Jones is 31. So it's a team that, except for Johnny Moore, is built to win now, and they're not even doing that. So I think for them, it's imperative to start looking. You know, if they can't close the gap in the next sim or two to get back in the playoff hunt, it's time to pull the ripcord and move maybe Issel to try to get some pieces. The Spurs are a team that we knew was going to be going through growing pains this year. They've got Isaiah Thomas and Mark Aguirre and Kevin McHale. It's a team that I don't think is in imminent danger of trying to make a panic move. On the other hand, if they continue to slide, they could be handing a really nice pick to the Pistons, but that's no reason to tank your future just to avoid giving away a pick. That's a sunk cost. You already got your guys. So I think they're probably likely to stand pat unless something falls into their lap. Then there's the Rockets. The Rockets had a disastrous offseason with Larry Bird in training camp and not protecting him. They're at the bottom of the division. I just don't see a direction with the Rockets right now, which is unfortunate. But, you know, they don't have a lot of young talent coming up. You know, Frank Johnson's okay, but not great. Rory Sparrow's okay, but not great. Jeff Lamp is okay, but not great. What they don't have is they don't have a difference maker on the horizon to put around Bird. So I can see somebody offering a package that pries Bird out of there. I think there's probably also some disappointment with how the offseason went. In the Pacific, the Warriors are currently atop the division. Even though they had three losses against the Blazers, sorry, Griebel, you knew I had to mention that. I think they are very satisfied with the Lister-Moses Malone combination. Eddie Johnson is doing good work for them. I think they would love to have one more offensive weapon. But, you know, right now, I mean, you've got Moses Malone. There isn't a better offensive weapon in the league. And I think... you know, I really like how they're currently constructed. I know Griebel is always very aggressive in trade talks, and he's going to probably find somebody to offload a pick for to get some more talent in there, especially if the Suns and the Blazers keep the pressure on. I get the sense he really wants to win the division. The Suns, I have a little harder time reading. Obviously, the key to this team is Magic Johnson. He has been... I would say single-handedly keeping the team afloat. You know, Maurice Lucas has kind of supplanted Bob McAdoo as their number two scorer. John Long is having a down season this year after an amazing season last season. And so I think I'm a little concerned about the Suns' depth, but as long as Magic stays healthy, quite frankly, they're probably a 50-win team. He's that good. And so they're going to be putting pressure on the Warriors pretty much the entire season. The Blazers, I can give you a little bit of insight into this one since, you know, I'm running them. I've been a little bit disappointed with Kareem's performance. He hasn't had the defensive impact I thought he would have. Even though his offense has slipped, which I kind of suspected it would, and yes, we're playing in fewer minutes, it's slipped more than I thought it would. So there is a possibility, if things don't turn around, that Kareem could be available toward the trade deadline. We shall see. The Lakers also, I think, still feel like they can get back into the division race if they can land their power forward. I see their trade block is constantly mentioning World Be Free and Jamal Wilkes. It just doesn't seem like they've found a taker for those two, for their power forward. And you wonder if they're not able to, are they going to be able to make the climb up the ranks, or are they going to be stuck behind Phoenix and Magic, and stuck behind the Warriors and Moses. It's the curse of playing in a division with super players like that, is you really have to have a powerful team to overcome that, and so far nobody has had that. The Clippers are another team that is, I don't want to say rudderless. They've accumulated several good young players. The problem is they're just in a really tough division. And I think if I were the Clippers, I would probably try more or less to stand pat unless somebody came to me with an offer I couldn't refuse. I think they have really good young talent. They're bad enough that they're going to get a high draft pick, and they're going to be adding to that. So I think given 2 or 3 years, they're going to be fine. And the Supersonics, of course, have been selling absolutely everything off for parts. They're trying to build around Danny Ainge, who just isn't ready yet. Could I see them making more moves? I don't see players on the roster that obviously don't fit the timeline. Maybe Bob Gross and Norm Nixon could be available, but I don't think those are going to command the premium packages that they could. But I do think the Supersonics are going to be maybe not as bad as the Pistons, but they're going to be challenging for the worst record in the league this season if the Pistons don't run away with that. So I don't see a lot of trade opportunities for the Supersonics or the Clippers. The Lakers would like to have one. I don't see it. The Blazers, maybe if they get tired of Kareem. Suns and Warriors, I don't see it. With the Sonics already having moved Greenwood, I don't see a lot more trades in that division happening, really. We'll have to look east and into the Midwest to see some of the trades happen. I think that's enough rambling for me for now. I look forward to the next couple of sims where we'll get some more clarity on how the divisions are going to shape out, and maybe at that point I can start talking about how the divisions have turned out. I think it's still a little bit too early yet to be able to make sense of what's going on in divisions. I think some teams' records are a little bit inflated by or deflated by home road splits. You look at the Warriors, they've had 14 road games and 7 home games, so you can expect they'll probably bounce up a little. By the same token, looking at the Bucks, they're 11-1 at home, so that's 12 home games. They're only 4-3 on the road. They've only had 7 road games, so they'll come back down to earth a little bit. So the teams I'm really watching for excellence are the Knicks, who are 9-3 on the road. They've had more than half their games on the road, and they're doing amazingly. And also the Nuggets, who are 8-4 on the road. I think that portends for a very strong season for those teams. So with that, we'll wrap it up, and we'll see how the next few sims turn out, and we'll be back in about a week's time.